Okay. I don't actually know what the title of this passage was supposed to be today, but this is what I've called it, based on what I'm going to say. I've called it, Who is Jesus and Who Are We? I don't know if that's a very good title, but there we go. Now, this is the first time in my preaching career, as it were, that I've ever been asked to speak on effectively the same passage more than once, because I discovered that 6 years ago, I spoke on the passage in Mark, where we have the same sort of passage about who is Jesus and who do others say that he is. So I was tempted to get out my notes and just say the same things to you again. I do still have the notes I discovered, and it's probably on the internet still. But there you go. Hopefully I won't repeat myself too much for those that were there 6 years ago. And then I also had the slight... the weight on my shoulders, because I looked up in the commentaries this passage in Luke, and at firstly, when it talked about Jesus saying, who do the crowd say I am, it said, this is one of the crucial passages of Luke's gospel. And then I went on to the Transfiguration, which we'll look at as well, and then again another commentary said, this is another crucial passage in the book of Luke. So thanks to Paul, whoever decided to give me this set of passages, that I've got two crucial passages in the same week. But there we go. So we have these key concepts. Now, I recognize that when I speak, I have a tendency to go a bit slow in the first few slides that I have, and then to struggle at the last few slides. So I decided to take a slightly different tack today, that I decided to give my application questions first. Okay, how's this novel for you? And then you can all go after that, knowing you've received pretty much everything I'm going to say. So here's the application questions. And I want you to keep these in mind as you go through what we're speaking about today. So here are the four questions. They're not my four questions. This came out of the Bible study that I've been doing in Luke recently. This is what it said. It said, ask yourself these four. What am I living for? What am I hoping to gain by my actions today? How long will those things last? And what would it mean to lose my life today in order to save it in the end? What am I living for? What am I hoping to gain by my actions today? How long will those things last? And what would it mean to lose my life today in order to save it in the end? Now, so we're thinking about first about who is Jesus? This is one of the crucial parts of the gospel, of the whole Bible. Who is Jesus? We need to have a fundamental grasp of that in order to be a Christian. And Luke, in his writings, he's already answered this question up to this point. And if you read through it, you will find some of the key statements that are made. But it's not from human mouths. The answers to the question so far come from angels and demons, the supernatural beings. So if you go back to Luke chapter 2, you would read in the traditional Christmas story, the angels say, he will be great and he will be called the Son of the Most High. Or indeed, a Saviour who is Christ the Lord. The angels have got it. They've got that sussed. And indeed, the demons that we have counted so far have also understood it. They would cry out, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Or later on, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? So they've got it. But the people that come along, they struggle. And so we see puzzlement, confusion amongst people. So these are some of the questions that we've already encountered so far in Luke's gospel. Is not this Joseph's son? This is when he was in Capernaum. That's what I preached on last time a few months ago. Or they would say, who is this who speaks blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God alone? Or when it talked about John the Baptist coming to Jesus, when he had his doubts, he said, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? Or there's even more questions. Who is this who even forgives sins? Who then is this that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him? And then last week we had Herod ask the question, John I beheaded, but who is this about whom I hear such things? People are confused. And perhaps the problem comes is they're not really asking the question. I know that's the words they say. It's not really who is this, but more what is this? They've got to the point where they're saying, this is not some ordinary person. There is something in a different ballpark about this person. Just like when we zoom into those pictures, and you can come up with, you just come out with the wrong answer at that point. That when you look at Jesus, you look at the things he's been doing, the statements that he's been making, the healings that he's done, the miracles that he's done, and people are going, we don't know how to process this. And then Peter comes along and he's asked the question, as one of the disciples, who do you say that I am? And he comes out with this phrase of, you are God's Messiah. You are the Christ. And this is the term from the Old Testament that was used about this chosen one of God that would be the Jews considered to be this savior, this rescuer that would come, that would change everything, that would give freedom from oppression. And so he gives this statement and he ascribes this to Jesus. This was a radical statement to say. And Jesus does not deny it. He's effectively saying, yeah, you're right. You're right. These are quite bold claims. This was what my commentary had to say based on another author said. Let me read it out and it'll make more sense. So what's far more breathtaking, though, in Jesus' response, he actually embraces what Peter says. In Matthew's account of these events, Jesus explicitly affirms Peter's confession in the strongest terms. That, in and of itself, does not make Jesus unique. History is full of megalomaniacal cult leaders who had delusions along these lines, but they all eventually faded from the scene because the truth was obvious to all but their small band of hoodwinked followers. But among the religious leaders who've actually established a following among reasonable people, only Jesus thought that he was the Messiah sent by God to save the world. Near the beginning of his chapter on Buddhism, in The Religions of Man, Huston Smith, who specializes in world religions and is not a follower of Jesus in any traditional sense, writes this. How many people have provoked this question, not who are you, with respect to name, origin, or ancestry, but what are you? What order of being do you belong to? What species do you represent? Not Caesar, certainly. Not Napoleon. Not even Socrates. Only two. Jesus and Buddha. When the people carried their puzzlement to Buddha himself, the answer he gave provided a handle for his entire message. Are you a god? They asked. No, he replied. An angel? No, he replied. A saint? No. Then what are you? And Buddha answered, I am awake. And with the suggestion there of saying, I am awakened. But there was no claim from him that he was anything other than an awakened man. And you can compare this with Jesus, who doesn't say, I am a man, I am an awakened man. He says, and others affirm, I am the Son of God, I am the Christ, I am the Anointed One. Jesus makes incredibly bold claims, like no other in history. And so you have to ask, well, how can we begin to process this? And God himself gives us an affirmation as we think through the transfiguration. We have the disciples they've made this statement. Well, what is there to back that up? And so we come on to the Transfiguration. We have God himself as this voice from heaven that says, this is my son. Listen to him. God himself confirms that what Jesus is saying is not just a ridiculous man, a megalomaniac cult leader, but this is someone different. This is someone out of this world. Now, with the Transfiguration, this is a really interesting time. So I'd not thought of this before, but the likelihood is that this may well have been either in fading light or in the dark at night time, because you have these three people taken up with Jesus, Peter, James, and John, and we read, they can't stay awake. which gives me great hope, because I can very rarely stay awake at these evening times. But they're really tired. These are strong fishermen, but they're struggling to stay awake. And suddenly they wake up, they come to, and not only is it likely to be fading light, but there is Jesus, and it says he is the same color as the brightness of lightning. Now, I don't know about you, but if you ever look out at lightning, it's incredibly bright. It's just, you know, this incredible flash. And it says Jesus is like this. He's looking like this. And it's a bit like he was wearing a veil for all of his life, over the whole of his body. And suddenly the veil is lifted, and you can see what Jesus is really like. And that's what Peter and James and John are seeing, what Jesus is really like. This is not just some good man, some teacher. This is someone from heaven that they are seeing. And that the crucial part, the emphasis by Luke is not so much what he looks like, but it's about the cloud. It's about the cloud. And so they are here on this mountain, and somehow they realize this is Moses and Elijah, and I don't know why or how. But there they are, the three of those together, and Peter and James and John. And then suddenly this cloud comes, and they're enveloped by the cloud. And it says they're afraid. You know, these are not timid men, but they are extremely afraid by this incident. And what Luke is trying to draw you back to is Exodus chapter 40. And so in Exodus chapter 40 is where they've just made the tabernacle. You know, they're effectively the forerunner of the temple. So they had this tent in the desert, and it said that the cloud covered the tent of meeting. It covered it, filled it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And so you can see the parallels that Luke is drawing out, that he says, you know, Peter talks about making, I think it said shelters in the version I read, but essentially tents. We want to put up some tents here on the mountain for these people as they come here. And did you see what Jesus and Moses and Elijah were talking about? They were talking about his departure, which in the Greek is the word Exodus. Okay? They're talking about his going to Jerusalem. There's all these things casting back, and effectively it's saying the glory of the Lord is on Jesus. This is him. This is the fullness of God in the flesh. And there they are in this cloud, and they're afraid, and they hear this voice saying, "This is my son. Listen to him." And so you would have thought that when finally some human being out of their mouth says, "You're the Christ," Jesus would be excited about this prospect, that finally someone's got it other than an angel or a demon. And yet Jesus gives us the puzzling statement of, effectively, keep it to yourself. Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone. Because people were going to get the wrong idea of that. Jesus is a powerful ruler, and he will one day come and judge this earth. But he had something that had to be done first before that message could go out. And the bottom one, this is what he said. And it's this word here which is very interesting. Must. The Son of Man must suffer many things. And repeatedly throughout Luke, if you look them up again, there's these various statements of, "I must do this. I must go to Jerusalem." He lived a purposeful life, and the point was not that he came for his own benefit, but he came for our benefit. He loved me and gave himself for me, it says in Galatians. He must suffer many things. And so the disciples had to realize that the claim of messiahship did not just come with pomp and glory, it came with suffering. It came with suffering. Who is Jesus? He's the Christ. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. And yet he said, "I have come to suffer many things, be killed, and yet be raised to life." Amazing claims amazing statements. And so we need to come to our own conclusions of, do we believe Jesus? The religious leaders did not believe Jesus. They heard his claims, and yet they put him to death. They put him to death. Who is Jesus? What are you going to do with Jesus today? We don't want to stand on the fence today about Jesus. It's worth too much to do so. Now, Jesus always surprises us. Now, I don't know if you were a salesperson or worked for an advertising company, how you would like to advertise Christianity, how you would come up with a great slogan to encourage as many people as possible to become Christians. You know, it would be a great advertisement for Christianity if you can say, you know, become a Christian, you'll share in God's kingdom for eternity, which is true, or, you know, there is, you know, God heals, God saves, God forgives, all these great things which, again, are true. And we could come up with some great advertising things that we could put on buses or at, you know, billboards, etc. But Jesus, it turns out he's not a very good salesman. He wasn't trying to be a salesman. So these are the three things that he comes up with as part of his advertisement for becoming a Christian, to being a follower, a true follower of Jesus. He said, deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me. And I wish I could make it easier for us to follow. But these are Jesus' words. Deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow Jesus. Now, the problem we have in our society is that we don't have crosses anymore in the same way. People wear them round their necks, and it's not talking about taking up that sort of cross daily. For the people that lived here, if you took up your cross, you were taking it to die. You were being nailed on it. And you would die. And so Jesus is saying, and I don't think he's being literal, but he's saying, every day that you follow Jesus, you're prepared to die to yourself. This is what John Stott said about it. To deny ourselves is to behave towards ourselves as Peter did towards Jesus when he denied him three times. The verb is the same, aparniomai. He disowned him, repudiated him, turned his back on him. Self-denial is not denying to ourselves luxuries such as chocolate, cakes, and cocktails, although it might include this. It's actually denying or disowning ourselves, renouncing our supposed right to go our own way. To deny oneself is to turn from the idolatry of self-centeredness. That's denying ourselves, taking up our cross, and follow Jesus. And this is hard. It's hard because we're paying a cost. Now, I found this advert online. I don't know whether you've seen it. Perhaps you already have. Without a TV, it was unlikely that I've ever seen it. And most of you probably don't come from Thailand, so you may not have seen it, okay? Now, unless you unless you're understanding the Thai language very well, you might need me to... I shall read out the subtitles for you, so for those that can't read it so well. So here is an advert to see what sort of things we can learn from this. Here we go. Let me help, says the man, as he helps the lady lift up her trolley. Sign says for education. What does he get in return? They're doing this every day. There you are, she shouts. He gets nothing. He won't be richer. Won't appear on TV. Still anonymous. Not a bit more famous.
สิ่งที่เขาได
้
คือได้แค่ความรู้สึกได้เห็นความสุขได
้
เข
้
าใจ
Riches a deeper understanding
ได้ความรัก
Feels the love.
ในสิ่งที่เงินซื้อไม่ได้ได้โลกที่สวยงามกว่าเดิมในชีวิตคุณอะไรคือสิ่งที่คุณต้องการมากที่สุด
ไทยประกันชีวิตเชื่อในความดี
Life insuranceThe comments on the online video said, "How is that plant not dead for overwatering?" Anyway, I mean, I don't know if that made you emotional. It got me yesterday. But the difficulty is that Jesus is not saying, "Pay the cost so that you can receive happy emotions now." He doesn't say, "Pay the cost, you'll reap the rewards now." It's not what he says.He just says, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow. That's a nice story. And, you know, we all like to behave like that. But effectively it says he's received his reward. That's not what we're doing. We're not setting out to be nice people. We're setting out to be followers of Christ, doing what he says for his sake and for his glory.I was reminded of this sort of picture, which you often get in tracts. And I was quite glad I didn't have to draw it out. And I managed to find an online one that I could to pull in. And this, it reminded me of this. That effectively in the middle here of the picture, we have a chair. And we have, it's the throne. And we have the circle is kind of your sphere of influence. It's your life. And we have self on the throne and we have Christ on the outside.And the interests that we have in our lives are completely directed by our own choosing, by ourselves, and we often therefore get discord and frustration in our lives, with the inverse being a Christ-directed life, where this time on the throne is the cross, is Christ on the throne, and we're still there, but we're at the foot of the throne. And instead, the interest at this point, it's not like suddenly we become...impersonal people that don't have interests, that don't have gifts and skills and talents to use, that we just sit in our beds and do nothing, or we go into a monastery and live a holy life somewhere by ourselves. But our interests now are Christ's interests. They're directed towards Christ. And I know it's all a little bit abstract still, but somehow we have to get into our own minds, into our own hearts, that we can live our lives, we can do things in our own lives, and actually they're our own interests. They have absolutely nothing to do with Christ. They're what we want to do. And it's when there's the conflict that we have to decide, are we Christ or are we ourselves? Who's the ruler? Who's in charge? Who's in charge of our lives? Not that doing things for ourselves is necessarily wrong in itself. And it's not like I can come in here and say, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that, because that's not what it's about. But it's about, as I look at my life daily, am I taking up the cross? Am I daily denying myself and saying, it's not about me, it's about Christ? This is what it says in Galatians. I quoted a bit of this earlier, chapter 2, verse 20. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And again, in Corinthians, you are not your own, for you were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body. This is what Matthew Henry, a commentary writer, says. We must live a life of self-denial, mortification, and contempt of the world. We must not indulge our ease and appetite, for then it will be hard to bear toil and weariness and want for Christ. We are daily subject to affliction, and we must accommodate ourselves to it and acquiesce in the will of God in it, and must learn to endure hardship. We frequently meet with crosses in the way of duty, and though we must not pull them upon our own heads, yet when they are laid for us, we must take them up, carry them after Christ, and make the best of them. I know that many people in this church probably suffer far more than I do, and I'm not trying to be flippant about suffering or difficulties, because we have them. We all have them in various ways. But Matthew Henry, what he's saying here is, if we make life too comfortable for ourselves, then when the difficulties come along, we will shirk away from them. That sometimes it is good to take the hard choice in our lives simply because it prepares us for what God wants for us. Because we are not called to a life of ease, we are called to a life of obedience. And so one of the things I wanted to do now is, for once, and rather than having a children's talk, I'm going to have a teenager's talk. So put up your hand if you're a teenager, just to embarrass you. Joshua, you're a teenager. And Abigail, you can listen in too, because you're almost a teenager, okay? So I've read a book called Do Hard Things. I don't know if you've seen it before. It's intended for teenagers. And it's two teenagers themselves who effectively are writing and trying to rebel against the attitude that teenagers can't do very much. That actually teenagers are capable of a great deal, and he encourages them to do hard things. And I'll go into what that means in a minute. But I just wanted to read this example that they give in the book to you. I was very struck by this, especially as I thought about my own teenage years and the wastedness of them at many, many times. David was born in 1801 near the city of Knoxville, Tennessee, where his father was serving in the state militia. At 10 years old, David began a career at sea, serving as a naval cadet on the warship Essex. At 11, he saw his first battle. At age 12, David was given command of a ship that had been captured in battle and was dispatched with a crew to take the vessel and its men back to the US. On the journey home, the captured British captain took issue at being ordered around by a 12-year-old and announced that he was going below to get his pistols. Out of respect for his position, he'd been allowed to keep them. David promptly sent him word that if he stepped foot on deck with his pistols, he would be shot and thrown overboard. The captain wisely decided to stay below. And that man was, what was his name? I can't find his name. David somebody or other, who turned out to be sort of a famous person, I think, in the Civil War in America, sort of a naval man. And I'm not suggesting that every teenager is a gifted naval person, but what struck me was the fact that at 12 years old, he was capable of captaining a ship. He was capable, not that I would agree with this, of carrying a weapon at 12 years old. And they give other examples of females that could do the same sort of, not naval things, but, you know, had other sorts of things whereby they were functioning what we would not consider normal. And in fact, the thing which then really struck me, and this speaks more like to me as I was as a teenager, he then talks about what is it that we expect from our teenagers? Where is it? Oh. They did a Google search for teens and expectations. The top result was about teens, drugs, and alcohol abuse, but another was for an article called A Parent's Guide to Surviving the Teen Years. Okay, this was the one that jumped out to us. We seemed promising, so we clicked the link. When you set up a formal set of expectations for your teen, you begin to set up for succeeding in meeting those expectations. So we were thinking, this is great. Okay, so first, preteens and younger teens, aged 10 to 14, you are expected to make your bed every day, be able to take a message on the phone, clean your room every week with help from mum and dad. Then comes the older teens, 15 and up. Besides everything on the younger teens list, you're expected to do a daily chore, just one, like taking out the trash, make sure the gas gauge stays above a quarter of a tank, and clean your room every week with no help from mum and dad. The article also includes an encouragement to parents about the list. Please do not feel that your teenager should be doing all of them. Phew, we were getting worried there, they said. Now, I'm not saying that that necessarily we need to be doing, you know, stuff like naval battles. But it's just this expectation of we can't do hard stuff. We can do hard stuff, and teenagers particularly are great at doing hard stuff because they've got the energy and they've got the skills to do that. Don't set your sights too low. And they talk about five kinds of hard things. We're not talking about naval battles. We're talking about these sorts of things. Things that are outside your comfort zone. And adults, this is for you too. What goes outside your comfort zone to do something hard? Not for yourself, but for Jesus Christ. What things go beyond what's expected or required? How can you take the initiative? How can you collaborate with others? Things that are too big to accomplish yourself, but joining with others, we could do big things. As a church, what could we do that's big for Christ? Things that don't have an immediate payoff. You know, the guy in the video, it didn't come immediately what he was trying to do, but it did come. Things that challenge the cultural norm. If we're not willing to pay the cost daily, that when we're really asked to do something for Christ, we won't want to pay it. We need to be preparing ourselves for that. I've showed this clip before, 6 years ago. Some of you may remember it as I sort of finish things off for the last song. Now, if you've heard of Marge Saint, she was one of the husbands of the men who died at the hands of the Alca tribe in the 1950s in Ecuador. She went on to do other things. She remained there for a while and did other things. And this is part of snippets of her life story. And it's the phrase, particularly that Liz and I have never forgotten, that she talks about.
Our hospital actually was just within running distance. I don't say walking distance, because by the time we got off duty, we had to run to get down to the Church of the Open Door downtown Los Angeles. And every Saturday night, there was a real live missionary that told about their work. I had never met a real live missionary. And I remember hearing Ruth Stahl from Peru one time. She told us about her life in Peru. And I said, I was just ready to commit my life for missionary service, but I could never live the life that she's lived. Well, as I look back now, I lived more than the life that she lived. We'll always say ask for those who'd be willing to commit their lives to go to the mission field. And I remember coming down from that third balcony all the way down the steps down to the front, and I told, now this is getting emotional, and I told the Lord that I wanted His will for my life at any cost. And little did I know what that cost would be, but it still has been too much. And even now with cancer for the fourth time, I still want God's will at any cost. Though this certainly would not have been my choice, neither would it have been to have two husbands die, what seemed to me to be prematurely, but I'm sure it wasn't in God's plan. And then one day, the word came that I had cancer for the fourth time. wasn't very good news. But then I hearkened back to that night at the Church of the Open Door when I had said, "Your will for my life, Lord, at any cost." This is a cost I really hadn't thought I'd pay, but I'm paying it. I'm paying it willingly. I'm grateful for the good kids, their spouses, and the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. And if I could go back and make that statement again that I made in about 1946, I'd do it again.
Your will for my life, Lord, at any cost. Can I encourage you this week to think about the four things that I mentioned at the start? What am I living for? What am I hoping to gain by my actions today? How long will those things last? And what would it mean to lose my life today in order to save it in the end? I would encourage you to encourage each other, that I would encourage you, you'd encourage me, that we'd be willing to do those difficult things in our lives that we would often shirk away from, not just for the sake of it, but for Christ. That when we are faced with the choices, and we know what the world's choices would tend to be, they would tend to be the easy choice, they would tend to be the claiming my rights choices. But as Christians, can we encourage each other, not just to go for what's easy, but maybe for the more difficult decision, but we can encourage each other to do that for the sake of Christ. If you want to have those questions on a piece of paper, there's a handout at the end if you'd like to come and take one for you to help think that one through. We've thought about who is Jesus. Who is Jesus? Jesus is not just a good teacher. He's not just a prophet that was mentioned by people in the past. He's not just John the Baptist raised from the dead. This is the very Son of God whom we serve, who loved us, who died for us, who's risen to life and is one day going to come again. And we can serve him, not by just being good people, but we can serve him by taking up our cross daily. We can deny ourselves and say, "You are more important than ourselves," and we can follow Jesus. Shall we sing for the last time, 1129, with a prayer, "You fed the hungry." And I'll give a prayer and then we'll finish.